Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be speaking to this group. And really, Jay is correct. Much of what I have to say this week and next week is based on research. It wasn't quite a master's degree, but what in Oxford terms is called an MPhil many, many, many years ago. More complicated than that is the fact that that I was stupid enough to break my glasses about 10 days ago. These are brand new glasses, and I'm not quite certain at the moment how to where to focus. So if you see me sort of squinting, it's nothing personal. I want to speak this week and next week about the foundations of orthodoxy in the modern world, in particular the part played by Rabbi Moses Sofer, the Chasam Sofer. And next week, talk about how that impacted the personality and the ideas of the Chasam Sofer, impacted on the Yeshuv in Jerusalem, the pre-state Jewish settlement in Jerusalem, the 19th and 20th century, and how the group that we see so often nowadays, regrettably on television, the Tzuri Kata, developed directly out of this. And to explain a little bit about what the underlying ideology of Natsuri Karta is, etc. But I want first to spend just a few minutes, because to set the context here of the circumstances that that form the backdrop to the Chasam Sofer's ideas. The Chasam Sofer, by the way, just so you get an immediate time fix, was born in 1762 and he died in 1839, right? 1762, 1839. So we're looking at the turn of the 19th century. But to understand the man, you have to understand the context. And of course, the context in which he lived, worked, and developed his ideas was the total breakdown of the boundaries around Jewish society in medieval times. This material, I should say, normally would be about five lectures, and I'm working hard to compress it here. But normally at this point, all of my students at school and elsewhere know that I give out a handout that has two big circles on it. And one circle has a diagram of the makeup of feudal society, what the medieval world looked like, of a large circle representing any state, and inside it a number of sub-circles representing the feudal groups within that state, the church, the nobility, the merchants, the guilds, the Jews. Yeah? And each of those represented very self-contained groups. They had their own law, they lived by their own law, they enjoyed self-government and autonomy, and their authority was enforced by the figure at the center of that little diagram, which is a crown, right? Whether it was a prince or a duke or a king, didn't matter. The deal was, in feudal times, obviously I'm being very simplistic, but the deal was, okay, I'm not interested, this is the king speaking, I'm not interested in any of you people as individuals, right? I don't deal with individuals. The individual has no rights and has no status, but as groups you do. So I will, here's the bargain, you, the Jews, the nobility, the church, whoever, every year give me your tax, and in return I will do two things for you. Number one, I will defend the boundaries of our state. I will have the army, I will defend the boundaries of our state. Number two, I will enforce your own internal self-government, your own internal rule of law, which in Jewish case, of course, was halakha, rabbinic law, whatever. These boundaries, although they were not concrete, in other words, the interaction between them was a lot more than we might sometimes imagine. Nevertheless, in terms of individual status, they were almost impermeable. You could not move from being a Jew to being a merchant, or from being a merchant to move into the church, right? This is what you were born into, this was your state in life, and that's where you were. The process of emancipation, right? The process of emancipation, both its climax and its beginning, was of course the French Revolution in 1789, basically broke down those boundaries. And the second circle in my diagram is one big circle with millions of tiny dots in it, and every tiny dot represents one individual citizen. Because as we live today, the state, every one of us, is an individual citizen of the state in which we live. The Jewish community as such has no civic legal status in our lives. We are individual citizens of the countries in which we live. And of course, the huge consequence of that is that, and this is the underlying thing, that in the modern age, in the open society, two things. Number one, there are no boundaries. The boundaries are completely permeable. And number two, being Jewish or Christian or anything else becomes a voluntary matter, right? Becomes a voluntary matter. The state does not concern itself whether you or I or anyone else believes in the religion that we keep, that we subscribe to. It doesn't concern itself about whether we are interested in beekeeping or football or anything else. Yeah, it does not concern itself with regulating or setting boundaries, except in certain ways, around the private lives and the private beliefs of its citizens. Truth be told, that of course nothing happens in a vacuum, and the French Revolution, the famous debate in the French National Assembly in 1790, where Count Clermont-Tonnerre laid down the rule for Jews in open society. In 1789, all French citizens got liberté, égalité, fraternité, except the Jews. A little later on, in December 1790, the French National Assembly debated the question, which in itself is a whole interesting thing, of whether or not Jews should be included in the New France. And our best friend in that debate was a gentleman called Count Clermont-Tonnerre, who said, to the Jews as a nation, nothing. To the Jews as individuals, everything. And that really laid down the political policy of all enlightened states. Jews as individuals could have entry into European society as free citizens. Jews as a group lost their distinctive identity and and their right to determine their own affairs, except on a voluntary basis, as did, of course, every other group. But as I said, that was both the climax, but also the climax and the beginning. It was the climax insofar as by 1789, the rule of classic rabbinic authority in Europe was already heavily under attack. For a long, long list of reasons. Among those reasons, this is not the whole list by any means, but among those reasons were, number one, the spread of the breakdown of feudalism, the breakdown of medieval thought, the beginning of rationalism, the beginning of enlightenment. And wherever you want to put that, Amsterdam was certainly regarded, as far as Jews were concerned, was one huge center. The development of liberal ideas in France during the 18th century, the encyclopedists, those who theorized about man's political status in society, those who theorized about the nature of political freedom and the nature of political status. But there were many other things as well. The scientific revolution, right across Europe, the scientific revolution, which made deep inroads into classical Jewish thinking as well, particularly in Western Europe, caused many people to stop and say, hey guys, what's going on? It turned the world Jewish and non-Jewish upside down. Geographic discovery, the fact that lands were discovered that were not mentioned in the Bible, Africa, Australia, America, upset people very much. It changed their map of the world. Even such things as the discovery of hitherto unknown animals, not mentioned in the Bible, caused great theological turmoil in Christian and to a lesser degree in Jewish circles. When the first zebras and the first hippopotamus arrived in Europe, there was a great deal of confusion because people said, what are these animals? Our world is shaped by the biblical worldview. Why aren't, what are these animals if they're not mentioned in the Bible, etc., 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 etc. Internally, right, internally, and this goes to a whole series of scientific developments, astronomy, geography, medicine, right? In medieval, in pre-modern times, how did people explain illness, right? Illness was either a visitation, punishment, divine punishment, or it was the result of the fact that your defenses against demons had somehow been broken through, and that illness was because a demon had somehow got to you. Well, when Van Leeuwenhoek, the discoverer of the microscope, discovered germs, and people began to understand infection, this also broke down many minhagim. It broke down quite a lot of what people believed. This was totally unsettling. The effect of the Muranos, the Jews particularly those after 1492, who then returned to Judaism. There is a whole literature about the philosophical questions, the philosophical activity of the former Jews, the Anosim, the forced convertees, I don't like using the word Muranos, in Amsterdam, Hamburg, London, etc., in the 17th century. Spinoza is the most obvious example, but there were many others who stayed within Judaism, but whose experience and whose questions and whose philosophy was deeply coloured by their Catholic background and by the fact, of course, that the Catholic Church itself, through the Reformation, had undergone huge instability. Sabbateanism, in the middle of the 17th century, the false messiah Shabbatai Tzvi, we tend to suppress this whole thing, but Shabbatai Tzvi, and possibly even worse, Jacob Frank afterwards, were immensely popular. I always say, if you want to understand the impact of Sabbateanism, you have a spare summer by the pool, read Isaac Bashevis Singer's first novel, Satan in Gore. Right? Satan in Gore is a tremendous evocation of the spread of evil in a small Eastern European village because of the belief in Shabbatai Tzvi. And the fact about Sabbateanism and Frankism was that you had in every corner of the Jewish world, in every corner, Sephardi and Ashkenazi alike, you had community rabbis standing up and proclaiming that the Messiah was about to come, had come, it was Shabbatai Tzvi, but 18 months later, they had egg on their faces. And this was altogether very undermining of the concept of rabbinic authority. Of course, by the end of the 18th century, the Haskalah, the early Jewish and non-Jewish and Jewish Enlightenment, was already highly developed. Moses Mendelssohn tussled with the question of what should Jews believe about the authority of religion and the authority of the state in the modern age. He tussled with challenges to Judaism from Christians. He translated the Tanakh he oversaw the translation of the Tanakh into German with a commentary in reasonably modern Hebrew. And all of these things, and of course by that time as well, Emperor Franz Joseph, right, had issued his tolerance patent, which on the one hand, and this was a pattern throughout Europe, on the one hand it gave Jews many rights, it gave them rights of accessibility to education, to trade, it removed many of the restrictions on where they could live, etc. But on the other hand, it also laid down for the first time educational curricula for Jewish schools, which were a mixture. It preserved certainly some elements of traditional learning, but imposed on Jewish schools as well a Europeanized, secular curriculum. It is difficult at this stage, and I'm zipping through this at 100 miles an hour, but it's difficult at this stage to understand the trauma that this represented to traditional Judaism and to the traditional Jewish communities. Obviously, there was a difference, not as great, I think, as we might imagine, as you went from Western Europe to Eastern Europe, right? As you went from Western Europe being the most enlightened, right? And obviously, as you went further east, the boundaries were slightly different. But everyone understood what was going on. And it's difficult to appreciate the trauma of the traditional Jewish communities and of the traditional rabbinic community. The entire system of authority, and this, I believe, is what is at the root of the Chasam Sofer's concern, the entire system of rabbinic authority was being undermined. Not only was it being undermined, but you see something, as the preeminent historian of this period, Jacob Katz, pointed out many years ago. What you see is a transfer of authority from rabbinic to lay people. For the first time in certainly in European Jewish communal history, the lay, what we would call nowadays, lay leadership, were able to control the organization, administration of Jewish communities. Obviously, not obviously, but at this time, it should also be noted that major changes were taking place in Jewish social and commercial mobility. You had what is known in historical terms, the Hofjuden, the Jews who were close to the imperial or courts of Europe. Many of them were suppliers and merchants and bankers and financiers and suppliers to the army and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But they were becoming, as I said, the boundaries were more permeable, and these were people who looked and spoke like European gentry. They were Jewish, but they were already in a halfway house to assimilation. And there is a lot of, yes. They could trade outside, right? But, for example, in feudal times, medieval times, Jewish merchants were subject to the laws, to rabbinic law in their commercial dealings. And, again, I'm being very simplistic, right? But both in Christian and in Muslim lands, if, for example, a Jewish merchant had a dispute with a non-Jewish merchant, right, they could elect, and frequently did, to have that tried in front of the Bet Din by Jewish law. They had to, if you had a dispute from somebody, if a Jew and someone who was connected with the church had a dispute, they had to decide under which law their dispute was going to be tried, right? But there was no, how shall I put it, the civic identity of a Jewish merchant in pre-modern times was very clearly defined, right? A Jew could not be a member of a medieval guild, for example, right? They were very, very clearly defined. Later on, but as the 17th, particularly 18th century went on, those boundaries became more and more permeable as Jewish restrictions on Jews were relaxed under the enlightened despots of Europe. You know, many of them achieved a great deal of what we would today call small a assimilation practice.
Yeah. Go into the kiddie, rabbinic infighting, where such as the Get Mikleva or the Jonas Nevshitz versus the Yaakov, and people taking all those sides,
yeah.
Really brought down, if they're calling each other names,
it certainly didn't help. And you had other instances as well where traditional Jews found, for one of the you mentioned the Ghetto of Cleves, but another famous instance was the case of the of Mecklenburg-Schwerin, right, where the local civic authority, you know, in those of you who watch horror films know that one of the great obsessions of the 18th, 19th century was the people being buried alive, right, you know, the coffin with the scratch marks on the lid, right. So this was in those days. There was some, a lot of dispute about whether it was possible to fix death. Of course, Jews traditionally would bury their dead within hours, right? In a place called Mecklenburg-Schwerin, which is a little principality in somewhere in Germany, Bavaria, somewhere around there, they decreed that no burial could take place until 3 days had passed after death, right? In order to prevent people being buried alive. The Jewish community appealed actually to Moses Mendelssohn to intercede on their behalf, and Mendelssohn said, "This sounds to me reasonable, right? I don't want to intercede." Well, and this caused a huge, again, huge rabbinic controversies. Why? Because there was no central thing. So the question then became, the question for all of Jews and Judaism, for all of Jews and Judaism, the question that they faced at the turn of the 19th century was, how do we respond to the open society? How do we respond to this totally new situation? Yeah, how do we respond to this totally new situation? What is the modus vivendi? What is the survival strategy, the way in which we can live in this situation? Over the next, that, by the way, I think is probably the major question that has faced Jews and Judaism for the last 1,000 years, right? There's no and everything the Torah in motion is about, right, is exactly about that question in one way or another, right? In one way or another, it's exactly about that question, to which we have developed a number of answers, but no single answer. Later on in the 19th century, certain answers, nationalism, yada yada yada, came into being. But I want to concentrate on three answers to that question that began to emerge, or emerged, I should say, in the first decades of the 19th century. In other words, between 1800, 1820, 1830. Yes, sir.
You mentioned the lay leadership taking over. Yeah. And even they lost their authority just because of this business.
Yeah, sure, they lost their authority because
they had no authority after that.
Well, yes and no. And they had authority over institutions, but they didn't have authority necessarily over individuals, right? But the three in the early 19th century, and this is not, like I said, as you get later on into the 19th, 20th century, other things emerge. But in the early part of the 19th century, there were three main reactions to the open society on the part of Jews and Judaism in Western and Central Europe. Number one was very plain, assimilation. Right? Number one was assimilation. If we think that today we have problems with assimilation, Jews for Jesus, etc., in the early 19th century, tens of thousands of Jews immediately converted to Christianity. If you look in the back of Reinhardt's and Mender's Floor, there's The Jew in the Modern World, there's a lot of statistical data about conversions to Christianity in Europe in the early 20th century. It's quite shocking. Many famous people did that. The classic case is Heinrich Heine, the German playwright, who famously said, "My baptism certificate is my entry ticket to European society." Why? Because at that time still, it was very, and it's something that we are products of this 200 years of churning and rationalizing, whatever, so it's not an issue to us. But in those days, it was exceptionally difficult for many Jews, not all Jews, for many Jews to visualize themselves both as Jews and Europeans. They saw a great contradiction between the two, for all sorts of reasons. Partly because, speaking to this audience, who, if I may say so, on average, are a little older than the audiences that I normally speak to, probably a little easier, but to make this point. But for North Americans, it's very difficult to understand the influence of the church, the dominance of Christianity in European culture. North Americans who've grown up in a great separation of church and state find it very difficult to understand how culture can be Christian. And particularly in Europe, particularly at that 200 years ago, there is no question that the if you look at the music, the art, even the to a great extent the literature of Europe was deeply rooted in European Christianity, and Jews felt as total outsiders, and in order to join that, right, they had to adopt the dominant religion. Plus, as I indicated before, Judaism at that time was somewhat in chaos. There was no or very little Jewishness that spoke the language of the people of that time. Yeah? Very few Jewish thinkers, very few rabbis who spoke the language of that time. So number one was assimilation. Guys, I'm out of here. Right? But number two, of which we are all the children, is what I call synthesis. Those Jewish movements, Orthodox and non-Orthodox, because they're the same, right? I hate to say this, but they're the same in this sense, who said, we wish to Europeanize Judaism, and we wish to show that it is possible to synthesize classic Jewish values, however they define that, with living in the modern world. And whether this was the early Reform movement, or whether it was later on Shimshon Raphael Hirsch and Neo-Orthodoxy, obviously their theology is totally different. I'm not suggesting their theology is the same. But in cultural political terms, right, they are both the same. They are synthesizing movements of movements that said, we will try and make a Europeanized Judaism. We will speak the languages of the countries in which we live. We will wear the clothes of the country in which we live, etc. The fact that we are here, sitting here, speaking English and looking at dressed as we do is the direct result of those movements. But there was a third, right? There was a third, and that is what I want to talk about today. The third movement was led by, to my mind, one of the most underrated and most important figures in modern Jewish history, Rabbi Moses Sofer, also known as Rabbi Moses Schreiber, known by the title of his books, Chidushei Torat Moshe, the Chatam Sofer, right? The Chatam, in the circles in which he is most revered, the Chatam Sofer. Yeah? I never hear anyone call him the Chatam Sofer, right? The Chatam Sofer. Yeah.
I think also a major consideration was for Jews to get ahead in that society, to go to university, to become a doctor, a profession. The door was closed; you couldn't get in.
Right. There were many, many reasons why Jews. Yeah, there were many reasons. Why Jews chose conversion to Christianity. But the Chasam Sofer was the architect, to a very great degree, the architect of what today we call Orthodoxy, particularly. Haredi, the Haredi view on Judaism and on society. It is astonishing. Right? It is astonishing to me that there is, as far as I know, no full-length treatment in book form of the Chasam Sofer. Those who wish to research him historically, academically, have to look at a bit here and a bit there. There is one classic essay by Yaakov Katz, Kavim le biografia shel Chatam Sofer. There's more recent work by a man called Moshe Zamet, a professor at the Hebrew U. There are articles here, but it is astonishing that there is no full-length study. There's one little book by a man called Eliezer Katz, no relation to Yaakov Katz, published by Mossad Harav Kook, but it's not totally satisfactory. Yeah. I think he influenced the way that the Hasidim managed to survive today in Brooklyn and London and Bnei Brak, etc. At the time, they were really two different worlds, right? The question of the Chasam Sofer's attitude to Hasidus is an interesting one. But Hasidism at that time had not yet spilled over the Polish border, really. I mean, a little bit, obviously, in Lithuania, but... Hasidus was not yet a force in Hungarian or Hungarian, certainly not in German or British or French or
in Russia,
absolutely. But whose influence is greater? Influence with whom? influence with whom. They were both major movements, but let me keep to this, because this is where we are. I will come on for a moment to his biography, but I want to start really at what was the turning point in his career, and what was iconic for all those to follow. And that was the affair of the Hamburg Temple in 1819. In 1819, the very first purpose-built, non-Orthodox, i.e. Reformed Temple was opened in the city of Hamburg, right? Before that time, there had been Reformed, small r, services in schools. All the interesting things start in schools, I have to tell you, right? Whether it's Sarah Schnierer or whether it's David Friedland, the interesting things always start in schools, because you're dealing with young people who are never satisfied with what there is. But there had been numbers of Reformed services in modern Jewish schools, i.e. schools that taught both traditional and general studies throughout Germany, but there was no such thing as a Reformed synagogue. There had been in Berlin, we know that in some private houses there have been regular minyanim of Reformed services, i.e. services that included prayers in German, hymns in German, alterations to Tefillah, but there was no purpose-built synagogue. The very first was built in Hamburg in 1819. And on this occasion, the Beit Din of Hamburg wrote round to, if my memory serves me correctly, 13 eminent rabbis in Europe and said, we want to ask you a shaila. We have opening in our city, this temple. It has the following things. It has an organ in the shul. They are making changes to the davening. There is going to be musical instruments played in shul, actually originally by non-Jews, but they said, you know, etc. Is this permitted according to halacha, right? And of course, the responses were published by the Hamburg Beit Din in a very famous book called Eile Divrei HaBrit, right? It's a little thin book. Once upon a time, I had a copy of a reprint, which somehow it's gone, but it's a very famous book called Eile Divrei HaBrit. And 12 of the 13 rabbis bring down every halachic source you can imagine to show every reason why none of these innovations were permitted by Jewish law. The response of the Chasam Sofer, although he deals a little bit in halachic stuff, contains a completely different approach. He says, you know, there's no point in arguing this, because these people do not respect our authority, and they don't believe in the authority of the sources we are quoting, and we are facing a completely new situation. And this was he was a brilliant political thinker, and a very sharp. Guy. I mean, it's an insult to Cornbury, right? But he grasped immediately something that no one else understood, because at that time there were still battles between, both on the Reform side as well, Aaron Chorin and others were arguing that from a halachic point of view, right, from a halachic point of view, it was possible to do this, you could find a heter, you could find a reason, it was Shasat Chak, it was this, it was that, whatever. Chasam Sofer had the two brilliant realizations. The first was at the time of the Hamburg Temple issue. He understood that the times were totally different, and this was no longer an argument about what was halakhically permissible or not permissible. It was just a different argument altogether, that for the first time there were strong organized movements within the Jewish communities, plural, of Europe, who simply would not pay any attention to halakhic or other arguments, number one. Number two, not directly connected to Hamburg, but absolutely central to everything else that we're going to say today, right, was his realization in analyzing this. And 1819 was the first time, until then, I'll deal with his biography in a moment, but until then he'd occupied two rabbinic posts, and he was known, but he wasn't a dominant figure. From the time of the Hamburg Temple affair, he became a leading rabbinic personality, not to say authority, in Europe. But as a result of that, he had a second insight, which was to shape orthodoxy from then until today and tomorrow, which was this. Listen carefully. If you're taking notes, this is what you have. This is one of the sentences you have to write down, right? He understood brilliantly that one of the freedoms of the open society was the freedom not to take part in it. Yeah? One of the freedoms of the open society was the freedom to reject it. Yeah? Which was, at that time, if you can imagine how much Europe was caught up in enlightenment and in emancipation and in new opportunity and in new learning and in everything, it was not only a brilliant insight, but it was actually an exceptionally courageous, in my view, an exceptionally courageous insight. He understood very clearly, that the threat that Jews and Judaism faced was the complete dismantling of classic rabbinic society and classic rabbinic authority. And in trying to work out how traditional Jews and how rabbinic authority could survive in the open society, he understood uniquely that one of the survival strategies for Judaism in the open society was cultural self-isolation and withdrawal from what it had to rejection of what it had to offer. Who was he? Right? Who was he? Yes. Okay, right, we're going to get to that. Right? I mean, he did not reject all secular knowledge, right? But he was very choosy about what was acceptable and what wasn't. Yeah? Sorry?
Aaron Schreiber, I don't know if you have a relation. And one of the tour managers a couple years ago,
about what he.
The one's approach.
Yeah.
He wasn't as rejectionist of secular studies as one might think.
Yeah, right. We'll get on. We'll get there. We'll get there. Yeah, we'll get there. As I said just before, it is astonishing at the beginning. It is astonishing that he has never received proper, comprehensive historical treatment. That his teshuvas, which number I think about 1,200, 1,300, have been printed for years. His drashot, fairly new editions, came out in the last 15 or 20 years. His correspondence, there's a huge amount of material on the Chasam Sofer. In certain areas, there are certain gaps, but there's a huge amount of material on him.
Some was even censored.
Yeah, there's all sorts, right? There's a mountain of material on this man, on his influence, on his students. It is astonishing that there is no full-length, 600-page biography of him. Because he is the ideological founding father of orthodoxy in the modern world. He was born in 1762, actually not in Hungary, but he was born in Frankfurt am Main. He had two teachers. One of them was well-known, Rav Pinchas Horowitz, the author of the halakhic work, the Haflor. The other is much more mysterious, but appears to have been much more influential, and this was a man called Rabbi Nathan Adler. Nathan Adler, by the way, there were two Nathan Adlers. One of them was around the same time, was chief rabbi in Britain, right? It's not the same one. Yeah? Nathan Adler in Frankfurt appears to have been a remarkable person, but he did not leave a single piece of writing behind him. Yeah, so we know very little about him. For whatever personal reason, he didn't want any writing. He either didn't write or he refused to have them published. Nathan Adler appears to have been a Kabbalist. He appears to have been something of a tempestuous personality, and he appears to have been very machmir. He appears to have have imposed many stringencies on himself and on his circle and on communities that he served, which is why he moved around from place to place. He was the Rav of Frankfurt for a time and had to move on because the community wouldn't stand for what he wanted to impose on them. But Nathan Adler was really the mentor of the Chasam Sofer. It is tantalizing that we know so little about him, but very often the Chasam Sofer refers to him. Various people have collected odd sayings of Nathan Adler that appear in different places, but we know very little about him. The Chasam Sofer followed Nathan Adler around in Europe, but eventually he got married, i.e. the Chasam Sofer got married, and he spent his early life in Mattersdorf and in Pressnitz. In 1806, which would have made him 43, 44, in 1806 he accepted the Chasam Sofer accepted the Kisei HaRabbanut, the rabbinical post in Pressburg. Pressburg is otherwise known as Bratislava, right? Those of you who know the geography of Hungary, Czechoslovakia, it's sort of there in the middle between Prague and Lake Balaton. But he is interesting. Again, there's a very interesting quote here of a letter that was sent to him. Those of you who've heard me talk about Jewish history before know that I don't hold from the art scroll version of Jewish history, right? And, you know, very often people project early Europe as being, you know, a totally calm, everyone was very frum, everyone was very innocent, you know, everyone kept the mitzvahs. This is the letter that was sent to the Chasam Sofer by a group of Balabatim in Pressburg before he arrived. It's in a sort of bastardized Yiddish German. Yeah, so now try and translate it again. Kan Mokom Pressburg. Unzeroiv Masa Matan mit Seichri Mashalom ibne Yisrael Hema. This is Pressburg, right? Most of us are in trade and merchants with non-Jewish merchants. Vim sorry Gudole Hamadina Bestate. And we are in good standing with the princes and the great ones of the country in which we live. In other words, they are, as I mentioned before, Hofjuden, or if not exactly Hofjuden, already very eminent. Mechamas ze zint kamo v'kamo mimenu gut svingen lil bosh b'malboshim achubodim kiyete ha'amim. Because we mix with the non-Jews, right, we are accustomed to wear... Sorry? We are forced to wear respectable clothing like the rest of the peoples among whom we live. Lagaleach shah harosh bahazaken, we shave our hair and we shave our beards, right? Af bi mei hamoed bahasfira, even during Cholamoid and during Sfiras HaOmer, nashenu v'noseinu nosnim b'pochei nehem, right? Wives and our daughters wear makeup. Pe'a nachris b'roshehem. They wear wigs on their heads. Yeah. Te'lachna ona va'ona elu lahanhig hazman. Yeah. They go around. I suppose this means they go to concerts. They do this. They do that according to the customs of our time. Ve'elu leparnas anshei beisom v'hadavori. Ve'elu leparnasas anshei beisom. Some of the women, I think this means some of the women also indulge in trade, right? In other words, they're out in the thing. V'hadavarim v'haminhagos ha'ela v'enzi oich v'enei morei harav nich gantz kahagen zayn zolten. Yeah? And, you know, if you don't like this, Rabbi, right, if these are things that don't find favor in your heart, yeah? If these are things that you don't like, lessen zich kan v'ir gedoyle kazos nicht anderen. Yeah? Don't come. Right? You don't like this?
You can't change them.
Can't change them. Right? Don't come. Don't come. You can't change them. Right? So, you know, this is not the sort of letter a rabbi wants to receive before he takes up his new post. But it's an indication number one, of what was actually happening. And this is Pressburg. You're not talking about Paris. You're not talking about Amsterdam. You're not talking about London. You're talking about Pressburg, which is in Central Europe, right? Central Europe. In 1806, this is, right? In 1806. That is what was already happening. Not only was it happening, but here you see, from a historical point of view, that the Banabatim felt themselves able to send a letter like this to their incoming rabbi. Yeah, they didn't fear what the result might be. They had the, they felt they had the power. So he came there in 1806, and he started. Someone mentioned Napoleon. In 1809, 3 years after he came, Napoleon laid siege to Pressburg, and he wrote a very famous diary about how he whether to escape from the city, not escape, but we're not going to go into that today. But from that time on, he understood, and he built his rabbinate in Pressburg, in Bratislava, totally, totally on an ideological basis to set a template for the survival of traditional rabbinic Judaism in the open society, which, as we see from this letter, had already reached there, right? Had already reached there. What were some of his tactics here? One, from an early time, one of his tactics, which will possibly resonate here a little bit, was to, as Jacob Katz puts it, to obliterate the differences of degree within Jewish practice. In other words, to make every minhag equal in importance to every rabbinic commandment, and every rabbinic commandment equal in importance to every Torah commandment. Yeah? So that his writings and his drushas say very clearly, if you give up a minhag, it is equal to transgressing a Torah commandment. In this context, it wasn't only in this context, but he coined the phrase for which he is, and also at the same time, parallel with that, to resist every change. This is how we learn in school. This is how we daven in shul. This is how we dress. This is how we talk. Any change is wrong, and he coined his famous, he didn't coin it, it's a Mishnah originally, but he used the famous phrase, Kol Chodosh Asa Min HaTorah. Everything new, right, is forbidden by the Torah. Kol Chodosh Asa Min HaTorah. It's originally a Mishnah referring to the harvest after the Omer, which is called Chodosh, but he used it in that sense. In fairness, it has to be said, that he also used it at least in two or three places against new chumras, right? Against new chumras. One of the most famous is my memory going back to Oxford in 1974 tells me it's Aruch Chaim number 181, where he talks about shiurim. There's an argument about shiurim: how big is an egg? How big is an olive, etc. And he says, Lo lahafchides b'nei Yisrael, you mustn't terrify b'nei Yisrael by introducing new chumras about shiurim, etc. Ki kol chodosh asa min haTorah. Right? So he used it in both ways. He did not oppose secular studies altogether. Right? He didn't oppose secular studies altogether. But he was very picky and choosy about what was permitted and what wasn't. And as there is today, right? As today, he was much more permissive regarding mathematics, engineering, and such like, and much less permissive regarding philosophy, history, and the arts in general, right? For obvious reasons. He clearly believed in Kabbalah, but he did not make it in any way part of his public teaching, and was very clearly against the use of Kabbalistic or other teachings in popular, you know, amongst in popular discourse. He was very strongly against the translation of the Torah, particularly Mendelssohn's translation, which was at that time very widespread, and for two very interesting reasons. Number one, he was totally against Jews, as a matter of course, having access to the language and culture of the countries in which they lived. Because language was a prime means of communication and the transmission of knowledge and the transmission of ideas. So he was very against the use of German or the vernacular in shuls, in schools, in the home, etc. And we'll come on at the end to the text of his famous Zavar. But he also was against the translating the Torah into contemporary European languages, particularly for Jews, because he believed that by doing so, you would destroy by taking attention away from the Hebrew text, you would totally destroy the holiness of the Tanakh itself. And that if people learned it in translation, they would never understand the depth and the nature and the kedusha, the holiness of the text. Hebrew. Well, he would speak in Yiddish, but the study was, of course, in Hebrew. No, Yiddish was a Jewish language. Yiddish was a Jewish language because it, unlike German or French or Hungarian or whatever, it did not provide a bridge until much later. Right? It did not provide a bridge to European culture. Right? If you didn't know German, you couldn't read what was out there. If you don't know English properly, you can't go to a library and read Bertrand Russell. Yeah. So this became later on in as you'll see next week in the Old Yeshiva of Jerusalem, the language question became absolutely critical because there was a clear distinction there. I'm jumping ahead, but in the Yeshiva Eitz Chaim in Yerushalayim in the late 19th century, there was a big argument about whether they should learn Arabic or not. Right? Well, they should learn Arabic, and of course Moses Montefiore actually donated some money to the Yeshiva Eitz Chaim so they could learn Arabic, so they could learn trade, right? So they could indulge in it. And there was an argument between Reb Shmuel Salant, who was the chief rabbi of Jerusalem longer than Queen Victoria sat on the throne of England, right? For 60-something years. He died in his 101st year. There was an argument between Shmuel Salant and a follower of the Chasam Sofer who had recently arrived in Jerusalem. Shmuel Salant said over this question of Arabic in Yeshiva Eretz Chaim in Jerusalem, he said, Arabic is not German and Jerusalem is not Berlin. Right? Meaning that Arabic was not a bridge to a modern culture at that time. Right? It was also only a pre-modern culture, it was a pre-modern philosophy, and it was also the language of a closed society. Yeah. Tiny small p, progressive rabbis of Jerusalem had no objection, but those who were coming from Europe, from Hungary particularly, right, saw all foreign languages as bad. And the same thing later, and again we'll deal with this next week. Interestingly, the status of Ivrit and how the status of modern Hebrew in the Old Yeshiva of Jerusalem flipped from being acceptable to unacceptable. Right? But we'll deal with that next week. Well, he was... The Chasam Sofer was actually very particular about Hebrew grammar. But the systematic teaching of Hebrew grammar was identified as being characteristic of the early Haskalah, being identified as being something that from people don't do. I mean, I'm being anachronistic because they wouldn't use that thing. But the systematic study of modern Hebrew was characteristic of the Haskalah and of the early Reform movement, and therefore did not have a place in the curricula of those communities under the Chasam Sofer's aegis. However, as I said, he also understood that this question of translation was also part of the wider part of the wider struggle, because as Jews integrated more into general society, first of all, they lost the ability to study classic Jewish texts in the original language, and secondly, there was a strong, and you see this very clearly both in the Reform and in the early neo-Orthodox movement in Germany, there was a very strong move to Europeanize the synagogue service and Europeanize Judaism. The changes in the synagogue, the beautification of the synagogue, the formalization of synagogue music, all of these things, and with that went the need to have translations of prayer books and translations of Chumash, etc., into European languages. And he understood that once you had this social mobility, right, the demand for cultural accommodation, including translation, right, was not far behind. However, this was his day-to-day stuff. Let me look at some of his major achievements, and I'm going to concentrate just on two or three. Probably, to my mind, one of his two or three greatest achievements was the foundation of the modern yeshiva. In many books, you will read that the first yeshiva was in Volozhin and Lithuania, whatever. It's not true. The Chasam Sofer was the founder of the modern yeshiva. And what do I mean by that? You have to understand, again, I regret to say this, but you will read in some Jewish history books, right? Yeshivas have been going for thousands of years, hundreds of years. It's not true. Like everything else, there is a history to the institution of the yeshiva. Throughout the Middle Ages, the yeshiva tended to be a very small institution, normally of a small group of students gathered around, certainly in Central and Western Europe, a small group of students gathered around the town rabbi who would learn in the cloys, who would learn in the base medrash most of the day, right? But a typical European yeshiva might have been a dozen or 15 students, if that, right? And it was strictly an educational institution, right? Strictly educational. The Chasam Sofer's brilliance was to turn the yeshiva into an ideological institution, right? Into an ideological institution. He founded a yeshiva in Pressburg. I think I once knew, but I can't remember now, how many students they had at its peak. But the number 300 comes into mind. Please don't write that down, but that's what I sort of somehow remember. And he did two things with his yeshiva. First of all, he promoted the ideal of learning, something that is very prominent, as everyone knows, in today's Orthodox community, the ideal of learning. That and he was very definite, clear about this, that in the open society, to keep Yiddishkeit alive, the duty of from Jews was, particularly in the diaspora, again, we'll come on to that in a moment. The duty of from Jews was to sit and learn, number one. Number two, much more than that, was that he founded in a very aggressive, and I'm not saying in a bad way, in a very deliberate way, probably a better word, the idea that your Rosh Yeshiva was your Rebbe for life. Yeah, that your Rosh Yeshiva was your Rebbe for life. In one of the, there's a very well-known book called Igros Soferim, right? The letters of the letters of the Sofer family, which contains biography and many, many letters of two or three generations of the Sofer family. If I can permit a joke, he was known as the Chasam Sofer, right? The seal of the Sofer. His son was known as the Kasav Sofer, right? The writing of the thing. Then his grandson was known as the Shevet Sofer, the pen of the Sofer. And they say the one after that was known as the Tatwas Sofer, the mistake, right, the handwriting mistake. But he started the idea that in Igros Soferim, there is a list of over 100 graduates of his yeshiva who he placed in rabbinic positions all over Central and Western Europe. Number one, this is this is revolutionary. But number two is the fact that he directed their rabbinic careers from the time they left his yeshiva till the time that he passed away. He would not allow any graduate of his yeshiva to occupy a rabbinic post in a city where the Jewish community was already in the was being controlled by reform. He laid down all sorts of conditions. He was also responsible, something again not widely appreciated, for establishing the question of rabbinic contracts. If you look if you read history of rabbis in Europe all over the place, you see that they came and they went all over Europe. Rabbinical positions in Europe before the 19th century, before the Chasam Sofa, were extremely unstable appointments. They came, they went. There were many instances where major cities were without rabbis for years and years and years on end. Yeah, and it was a very, rabbis were really at the mercy of their lay leaders. Right, one year they got a salary, the next year they didn't, and they were out. The Chasam Sofa demanded proper contracts for his students who went to rabbinic positions. First of all, he instituted proper contracts with a term, but later in his career he insisted on tenure for rabbis in major European communities. He, as I said, he insisted that they go to places where they would be able to be masters in their own house. And of course, in a way, this led to the split in Hungarian Jewry in 1868. But I just want to spend the last few minutes talking about two other areas where he was absolutely clear. One was his famous ethical will, his tzavar, written 3 years before he died in 1836. He left it to his children, his family, and it makes it pretty clear. Do not touch the books of Moses Mendelssohn from Dessau, and your foot will never slip. The daughters may read German books, but only those which have been written in our own way, according to the interpretations of Chazal, Zichronim, Levracha, and absolutely no others, right? Cultural self-isolation. Be warned not to change your Jewish names, speech, and clothing. From the famous Midrash, Vayetze Yaakov Shalem, right? Shem, Lashon, V'malbush. Here is the principle of cultural self-isolation. Do not change your names, your clothing, or your language, right? And every Haredi who wears black hat and black suit, or Hasidim who wear Hasidish dress in the middle of modern European or American cities, consciously or unconsciously, are following the survival strategy laid down by the Chasam Sofa. But finally, I want to deal with the thing that leads on to next week, and that is the fascinating question of his support for settlement in the Yishuv in Eretz Yisrael, and his sort of defined by some as nationalism. He was a very, very great enthusiast of the settlement of Eretz Yisrael. As early as 1799, which is the same time as the Gro, etc., he was encouraging his followers to go and settle in Israel. And it seems to have been coming from two directions. Direction number one was he had a genuine love and appreciation of the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael. He lived in a time when increased communications and railroads and all sorts of things were making it, steamships making this possible, right? Making it possible. But number two, he clearly saw in Israel, and this again leads directly into next week, he clearly saw in Israel, which at the time was under Ottoman rule, a refuge from all the problems that Jews in Europe were having with enlightenment. And he clearly saw that in what was then Palestine, Jews could live under Ottoman rule in a in a pre-modern sheltered society, where the rulers, i.e. the Ottoman Empire also, had no interest in allowing in any of the things that were so problematic to Jewish life in Europe. They had no truck with secularism, they had no truck with enlightenment, they had no truck with anything else. Some of his actions were really very radical. He established an agricultural training school outside Pressburg in the 1830s. Unfortunately, we know very little about it, but we know that it existed. Yeah, he established an agricultural training school, and he had radical ideas, very similar to later classic Zionist thinkers, about the lopsidedness of Jewish life in the diaspora. And in his Perush on Vayikra, he writes, he quotes Rabbi Nehorai, "I should teach my son only Torah, but this applies only in the exile, where the Jews need the Torah to sustain themselves. In Eretz Yisrael, we should so order ourselves that we have all sorts of workmen and craftsmen that daily life demands. It should not be said that in Eretz Yisrael, no sandal maker, builder, exists, and they have to bring them in from far off lands." And he also, in another passage, says that someone who is occupied in bringing in the harvest in Eretz Yisrael is potter from tefillin and other positive mitzvahs. So he had very radical ideas. A whole trickle of his followers moved to Palestine, to Israel. He encouraged the Yishuv in Jerusalem rather than in Tzfat or Tiberia, where 19th century a lot of other people went. He encouraged the Yishuv in Jerusalem in particular. And of course, the first settlement outside the old city walls, Yol Salomon, what's now called Nachlat Sheva, was completely Hungarian, as was the first new agricultural settlement of the of Petach Tikva, right? Petach Tikva was the first agricultural settlement, and the first settlers of Petach Tikva were Hungarian Jews from Jerusalem. In fact, they failed because they were attacked by malaria, and within 18 months they had to pack up and go back to Yerushalayim, and Petach Tikva was then resettled. But he had a very, very, very strong influence on the Yishuv. And he was responsible, we'll deal with it more next week, for founding many institutions, including Yeshiva Eitz Chaim, including the Hungarian Kollel in Yerushalayim, which actually his son founded. But Hungarians played a very major part in the old Yishuv. By the end of the 19th century, however, there were two waves of influence of the Chasam Sofer on the old Yishuv. One was the stage I just described of the agricultural settlement, etc. And a number of visionaries, the fascinating character of Akiva Yosef Schlesinger, also came from out of Hungary. But they were generally somewhat aggressive, but pillars of the old Yishuv. By the end of the 19th century, however, Europe was beginning to nibble at the Yishuv of Yerushalayim. All the problems that the old Yishuv sought to escape by settling 19th century Israel were suddenly beginning to appear. And the arrival of one particular disciple and follower of the Chasam Sofer, Rabbi Moshe Yehoshua Leib Diskin, the Rav of Brisk, not the Soloveitchik Brisks, but another the Diskin Brisks, changed the cultural and religious climate Jewish political climate in Jerusalem completely. But we will deal with that next week. The Chasam Sofer passed away, I think, the day after Hoshanah Rabbah in 1839. His birthplace in Bratislava, I've never been there, I almost got there. Burial place, and I almost got there in 1970, but I never did. is preserved as a chamber underneath a major flyover, underneath a major road in the city. If you go on the website, you can actually see it. It's preserved as a sort of historic place. There's this sort of major intersection, and in the middle there's a little path and a little door, and you go in, and there is the burial chamber of the Qasim Sofer under a six-lane highway. But you can see that if you put in Schreiber or Sofer Bratislava on the web, you'll get to it pretty quickly. Substantially. No one tangled with the Qasim Sofer. His sphere of influence was very much Central Europe, right, not to the right, not to the left. The question of his relationship with Shimshon Raphael Hirsch is also, Hirsch's attitude to Qasim Sofer. Qasim Sofer was dead by 1839, and Hirsch was just starting, but it's a very interesting question, the relationship of the two, Neo-Orthodoxy versus Hungarian Orthodoxy, is a very interesting thing. But no one. He was by far the dominant figure in early 19th century Central European Rabbanus. I think much less. Eastern Europe was Hasid. I mean, at that time, I don't want to say overwhelmingly, but it was the rabbinic structure was totally different. I think it was different. Yeah.
Interesting point. The Ramoh was son of a very, very wealthy businessman, and he had his own yeshiva where he would actually support married people, and he placed his students, and he had constant contact with the students, although some sofer, placed them in small communities all over Europe, and that's how the Shulchan Aruch got accepted. Because he Ashkenized the Shulchan Aruch, and his students are the ones who spread it. It's the exact same plan.
I 100%. I think the difference was Qasim Sofer regarded himself as their Rebbe until the whole time.
No,
he did too.
There's a constant give and take for all the students.
Right.
But that's not the point I was trying to make. I was just trying
the placement system.
The
I don't think, with respect, in the same way, Qasim Sofer did it very deliberately and aggressively and directed them here, there.
It could also be that he had in mind, wasted his time, so many years of his life doing documentation, doing the notes on the Shulchan Aruch. He had a plan.
Also, the context in which the two rabbis were operating was completely different. Completely different.
Study of what happened in the communities around the Mediterranean basin, North Africa, Italy, and of course the Turks over there, Constantinople, because that's how these conversos made their way. And how did they confront enlightenment?
Okay, the question of enlightenment in Sephardi communities is a totally different one, and it doesn't really come up. There is one, right? For example, in Yemen, which everyone says, it was always there. There was an enlightenment. Yosef Kapach, right, Halichot Teiman, describes his grandfather in the 19th century fighting the enlightenment in Yemen, right? But it's a totally different, right? In the Mediterranean basin, I think it's a different, first of all, it's different between Christian and Islamic countries. And in Islam, of course, the Enlightenment took a different form, and it was much later. This Qasim Sofer really is, you're talking really only about Europe, not about the Mediterranean, certainly not North Africa.
Why did he freeze the dress as of his time? Why did he go back to Abraham and think he should wear something?
he froze the dress as it was in the immediate. The way that Jews dressed before they came into European society.
But that was the nobility of Europe.
I'm not sure it was necessarily the nobility. It was how Jews dressed, period, before the, the whole question. I mean, it's a popular thing that Hasidic dress is the dress of the nobility, etc. Yeah.
I heard you phrase the issue as Christ in times, how to regard
Well, no, the last couple of hundred years.
Right.
How we deal with the open society and emancipation.
So starting with the times of society.
Yeah.
So I'm asking exactly a little bit backwards, and I'm wondering, is this, was this a singular situation, or was it an incarnation, a new twist, some new permutation on the crisis of confronting a society with which the Jews are or are not engaged, which is really a repetition, even though a new
The emancipation is a completely new situation because Jews are no longer living under the authority of Jewish community. The Jewish community no longer has control, and Jews are individual citizens of an open society. I believe that is a completely new situation. Now, not to say that in all periods there wasn't the issue of how do you relate to, right? But the situation of the individual Jew, the choice, right? The choice that the individual Jew had was of a completely different order post-emancipation than pre-emancipation. And as I indicated at the beginning, you could already see that developing in different ways in the 100 years or so, 150 years preceding emancipation, but the situation, the Jewish situation is completely different. Because at the end of the day, in an open society, our Jewishness is voluntary. Our Jewishness is voluntary. And the areas of Jewish law that we choose to observe are completely voluntary as far as we're concerned, right? The government of Canada doesn't care whether I keep kosher or not, right? Plus, you see it even in the restriction in rabbinic, you know, it affects the whole of rabbinic culture as well. In pre-emancipation times, a huge part of Shaila's and of rabbinic literature is to do with matters over which the rabbis had real authority. They're to do with dinei mamonos. They're to do with commercial and other law. In post-emancipation times, the scope of Shaila's and shuvahs is drastically restricted to ritual halachic issues, which are the only areas that there is still authority over. You know, when I lived in Yerushalayim some years back, a neighbor of mine wrote a 400-page sefer on Hilchas Netilas Yadayim, right, on the laws of washing your hands, right? That is about 399 and a half more pages than any person probably wants to know on the subject, right? But why? Because yeshivas and kolim nowadays, yeah, have a total concentration. All the energy is being funneled into ritual laws, right? And Jay will tell you in one of his other hats, yeah, the application of Jewish commercial law is almost theoretical nowadays. Yeah.
One of the things you mentioned was the Chaim Sofer may not get equated to the Torah law. Given where he was going to Pressburg and the fact that he was almost making everything an all or nothing proposition, were there elements of that society that essentially ended up rejecting?
Yeah, I'm not going to say rejected Judaism because of him, right? But I did almost in the side say that the fact that he made it an either-or proposition is what, in 1868, there was a major split in Hungarian Jewry between Orthodox, Neolog, and status quo, right? What they call status quo congregations. And that was a result of the tensions within the community because between the rabbis who were of the school of the Sofa dynasty and those who were accommodating and compromising. Yeah, so I'm not going to say led to people giving up Judaism, right? I don't want to. But he understood very well that there would be casualties along the way. And he understood very well that the price of maintaining strictness and chumras and self-isolation was that this would be a recipe for a for minority survival. No question of it. Yeah. Eastern Europe, yeah. Eastern Europe was under, there was no enlightenment and no emancipation in Eastern Europe until much later. So the whole question of government, the structure of government authority and how the government controlled the Jews was totally different, right? Central Europe, Western Europe, what we call Germany probably. Split in half there, but the Western Europe of Western Germany, France, Holland particularly, Britain was a different sort of area entirely. Yeah. And
so what you're now calling, I happen to be Hungarian.
Yeah.
What you're calling Hungarian.
Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Moravia, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, basically. Yeah. Plus, of course, there are two other major communities that are not on the radar here at all. One of them is the Sephardi world, which, again, like Eastern Europe, was under a completely different structure. But, of course, it should never be forgotten that at the same time as all this is going on, North America is being settled, and the Judaism of North America is a completely different thing as well. North America is distinguished by the fact that it's the only Jewish community in history where the Orthodox were the last to arrive and the last to organize and are a minority.
Also, the
birth of
Zionism.
Right. Well, Zionism is a little later on here. A little later on. We're 30 or 40 years off Zionism. But this is what the Open Society caused major differences in Jewish communities and the Jewish world, and how they grapple with them and how they tackle them and how they evolve their survival strategies is what gives people like me half a living. Yeah.
And then the
right. Yes. Some of them, one or two individuals came west, a few well-known people, but most of them, the rabbinic ones, stayed in Central Europe. Later. Chassam Sofer didn't really like Hasidim. He was very suspicious of the institution of tzaddik and etc. He was not keen on Hasidism if he encountered it. Yeah, sorry, sir. I think he looked ahead. I think he was one of the most visionary, far-seeing people of Jewish life in the last, I don't know how long. And he looked ahead, like I said, in that he was able to analyze what were the implications of the Open Society, and how could he deal with it in the way that he wanted to. He was not, you see. One of the great mistakes people talk about in talking about the Chassam Sofer and subsequent Haredi leaders, right, is to say, they don't know anything about the modern world. He knew everything about the modern world. He knew more about the modern world than most of the people in the modern world, right? He was not anachronistic. He was not saying we're going to take this back. What he was saying was, I want to preserve that model of, the classic word here is authority, right? He was determined to find a model that would permit the survival of classic rabbinic authority in an open society. That was his thing. Not lay authority, not secular authority, not reform authority, classic rabbinic authority.
But recognizing that he
Well, what he did was adapt that model, right? I mean, he adapted that model in terms of the new society in which he found himself. He adapted and adopted a model of cultural self-isolation, yeah? And, you know, did it contain elements of the pre-modern feudal structure? Yes, of course it did. Was it the same? Absolutely not. It was totally different, and it was a different organization, a different thing. Now, you know, any element of transformation and change, you know, the most skillful transformations are the ones that no one realizes is happening. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's it. Thank you.
Next week we can pick up on the questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, everybody.